Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry about that. Hello, everyone. Technology has its own way about doing things. Hello, this is your radio host, Gigi Adams Evans, and tonight my very special guest is Catherine Falk, the daughter of the iconic actor, late great iconic actor, by the way, Mr. Peter Falk, actor of Columbo, the TV series where everyone was glued to the TV watching him with his 1001 questions and solving cases. My co-host tonight, Miss Anna Marie Holliday, and of course, PJ Sampson, who is not available tonight, but did leave a message for Miss Falk. We're going to get ready to rumble, and we're going to talk about the Peter Falk bill tonight. It's a wonderful pleasure to have her on the show, and I'm going to go ahead and give that message out to you, Miss Falk, so one moment for PJ to welcome you to the show as well.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Gigi. This is your co-host, PJ Sampson, a global advocate for the elderly. I am passionate about supporting the Peter Falk bill. Today I read something so profound on the Facebook timeline from the Catherine Falk organization page. It read, "My father was a person like no other I have ever known. He was my teacher of life, my listener of thought, and my nurturer of endless hugs and kisses filled with unconditional love and affection. There are not enough words that I can express to describe just how important my father was to me and what a powerful influence he continues to be. I dedicate this page and my advocacy to you. Because of you, I am Catherine Falk." Those words speak for many of us. Thank you, Catherine. Your father was a great actor, and through you, we know he was a loving father. We thank you for sharing your memories. We loved his movies and Columbo. I loved how he kept on hounding with questions those who had done wrong. Every case he seemed to have already solved it from the beginning. He gave them chance after chance to confess. Welcome to the artist's loft. Back to you, Gigi.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. And again, ladies and gentlemen, this is your radio host for the artist's loft, Gigi Adams Evans, with our special guest, Miss Catherine Falk, daughter of the late, great iconic actor, Mr. Peter Falk, along with my co-host, Miss Anna Marie Holliday. We also have Miss Falk, Reverend Dr. Ghani on the line, too. So, Miss Falk, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. That was so sweet. That's those are kind words. I really appreciate it. You know, listening to that just warms my heart.
Well, thank you very much. And we are so appreciative of you being on the show tonight also. And without further ado, I'd like to go ahead and jump into some questions with you to get it started. But ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to call in tonight, the number is 646-200-3817, and we have Miss Catherine Falk, the daughter of actor Peter Falk, on our show tonight talking about the Peter Falk bill. Catherine, what prompted you to create the Peter Falk bill?
Oh, boy. actually, you know, my case was all the way back in 2009. My dad had fallen ill after he had hip surgery. I guess, you know, when you suffer with dementia and early and onset Alzheimer's, when you go in for surgery and have, you know, and you're exposed to anesthesia, you run the risk of really escalating, you know, the effects of anesthesia are not good. And so when he came out of hip surgery, he just disappeared. And he was isolated. And my sister and I couldn't contact him. And so it fueled kind of, you know, an unfortunate situation where I was worried about my dad because we couldn't call him. And so I contacted an attorney and I just said, what are our rights and how do I get into my dad to see him? And that's when the attorney had said to me, the only way in is to go to probate court and to petition the court. And I had no idea what I was doing at that time. I was like a deer in the headlights, and I didn't understand what I know now. I didn't know then. And so I was under the guidance of an attorney, and I was told to file for conservatorship, and I didn't want to do that. So when I went into the judge, I just asked the judge you know, for visitation. And, you know, long story short story long, I just said to the attorney that was representing me then, I want to create a Peter Falk bill to streamline this long court battle, which cost me $100,000, close to $100,000, just to get in to see my father. I didn't want conservatorship, and I told the judge, you know, don't give me conservatorship, give it to his second wife, but can you give me visitation rights? And she did. At her discretion, she granted visitation, and hence that is where the Peter Falk bill began. In 2011, then my attorney emailed me the first draft. So it just kind of spiraled from that point forward. Is anybody on the line?
Well, it sounds like maybe this is Anna Marie Holliday, your co-host. I'm not sure if she fell off. Miss Catherine, that's you, correct?
Yeah, I'm here on the phone. Yes.
Well, I'll just come on in. Thank you so much again for coming in and being our special guest. I was reading also some of the things that had happened, and I was wondering, how do you or how does a person come in to present this bill to their family without causing chaos?
Well, I don't understand your question. Present the bill. You mean you're not presenting the bill. Go ahead.
Well, if you have family members that's also wanting to, you know, take over and not want you to be a part, you have a aunt or an uncle, how do you get them to understand that each person with dementia or Alzheimer's has rights?
Well, I mean, that's the whole idea, is that, you know, this bill evolved from the fact that, you know, I at one point thought the only recourse was to go into probate court, and I'm realizing with all of the countless cases that we have before us, and, you know, millions of people, especially people like my father and family members that are suffering terrible physical and mental illnesses, really lose their rights when you initiate a guardianship. In other words, my father, I don't know if this makes any sense, but my father was under an abusive power of attorney, you know, which what I believe was an abusive power of attorney, abusing and overreaching the duties under POA. So by me challenging, or anybody challenging a spouse or an uncle or whatever in probate court, you then take away more rights by putting your loved one into a guardianship. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is, you know, this bill is, you know, one step towards just protecting the rights of the ward. My advocacy is about 150% about protecting the right of the ward, not the rights of family members and the spouse or the POA. It's about what is in the best interest of my dad or somebody that's being isolated. And isolation in and of itself is really a crime. It's unfortunate, but it's happening. And, you know, it has to stop. I mean, it's something that's, you know, we're working on isolation as a crime, and we're working with, you know, different statutes to try to address this issue.
Mm-hmm. That's understandable. So you've got it implemented into 16 states now so far. So what does a person need to do to actually have it, you know, presented to their representatives here? Like, if, say, for instance, I'm in Georgia. What would a person need to do to bring it to Georgia to help to get this bill going to more states? How would that happen?
Well, right. So, you know, you would contact your local representatives. And typically what I do is I contact representatives or senators that are interested and have done past bills or legislation that are passionate about elder issues and whatnot. So I typically go to committees like the Aging Committee or the Judiciary Committee, you know, Health and Human Services. You really target certain committees where you are in front of representatives, or I should say politicians, that are passionate about our advocacy and are willing to, you know, look at the bill and say, oh, yes, this bill is in New York. Okay, so we're going to see how we can insert this in the existing statutes of New Hampshire or whatever other state. And so then we begin to draft, and we try to find, you know, put the legislation into states depending on, you know, what the state's statutes say already, you know. It's very tedious, but it's a long process.
Exactly. You know, with the gardenership and everything that's going on, what are the pitfalls of initiating the gardenership in the first place? I know that I was reading an article about how difficult it was for you to even see your father when he was ailing, when he was spiraling down, and even at the funeral you were denied. So what kind of pitfalls other than that to initiate the gardenership? What are some of the pitfalls?
Well, you know, the pitfalls are that families are, you know, when families are in dispute with each other, I think the first knee-jerk reaction is for a family member, like you have siblings that are fighting, or you have, you know, just family disputes. And the pitfall is that the minute you walk into probate court with a dispute, you take a small problem and you magnify it times a million. And people think that probate court is going to solve your problems. They're going to fix your family disputes. But really what they do, it costs a lot of money. And then typically, a lot of times, the judge will just say, you know what, I'm not going to listen to you, and I'm not going to listen to you. I'm just going to assign your loved one a court-appointed guardian. And then next thing you know, your loved one is, you know, in a full-blown guardianship. And then all of a sudden, you know, the family's really at war with each other. So my advocacy is about saying to family members when they call me, oh, you know, I'm going to go to probate court, I say, good luck with that, because it's just going to make matters worse. I really advocate for mediation or other ways to try to keep it out of court is really my advocacy.
Exactly, because I totally disagree with the judicial system having to say who can and cannot go to see their loved ones, especially when they have dementia or Alzheimer's. We have a caller on the line, a 347 exchange. Hello, caller, how are you tonight? Hello, caller? Okay, we have...
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I would like to say from a caregiver side, I think that that's an awesome bill that has been put in place, because I think as she was speaking, she said that the most important part is that the person who has Alzheimer's or any other type of disablement is taken care of, and that's what's the most important part of it.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Back to you, Anna.
Thank you so much. Again, thank you, Catherine, for joining the show on tonight. I am trying to understand, if you're not going to have a guardianship and you have siblings, at what point do you go in once you see that your loved one is going into dementia or Alzheimer's? And I think a lot of times that maybe one brother or sister see that this is happening, and so they take control of the situation, and then they feel that they're maybe their brother or sister is over trying to rule them in the decision of their parents. So is there a time that you sit down and together as a family? A lot of them don't want to admit that this is happening. So at what point do you get together with your family?
Yeah, I hear, that's really, you know, people say the guardianship, that the epidemic of guardianship is incited by family disputes, and I want to be really clear about that. That's not really true. I mean, I can't tell you how many cases I have where, you know, an elderly woman's at home and she's hits 911 because she has a migraine headache, and her son's in New York and her daughter's in Arizona, and then all of a sudden, you know, Adult Protective Services are, you know, roaming the hospital hallways, and they do go in for an emergency petition for guardianship, and next thing you know, her house is up for sale, and there's a temporary order, and she's been put into a nursing home. So, I mean, there's so many different scenarios and variables to guardianship. It's not just about family disputes, and that is part of it. But I really, you know, I can't, I do have siblings or family members call me and they say, oh, you know, I can't take my brother anymore. And we're fighting over, you know, he's got power of attorney over my mother and he's not letting me see. And I've got no other recourse. I'm going into probate court tomorrow. And I say, it's going to end up being worse because a judge is going to throw up his hands and say, you're not getting guardianship over your mother and your sibling isn't getting him. I'm giving you a court appointed one. And most of the time, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of times, the court-appointed guardian exploits the estate, you know, I mean, beyond just taking a salary. They, you know, sell off properties and they're selling off cars. And next thing you know, the siblings are like, wait a minute, you know, we should have just settled this, you know, in mediation and just not even walked into probate court. And I'm just saying at what point, that's a very good question. You know, humanistically speaking, I would say, you know, the minute you begin to see that there's a conflict, there should be a way where there's open dialogue and family members really should, you know, be more mature than just to run into court. I just, you know, and I know that's a simple solution, but I'm telling you, it ends up being 10 times worse when you go into probate court because there are vultures in there. I mean, I know it sounds terrible, but it's, you know, the probate system is about, you know, overseeing the estate and the person, controlling the estate and the person. You know, you're not walking into family court. You're walking into probate court, which is really all about the money and the estate. So it's not a good place to go, you know. That's just my opinion, you know. And luckily,
so that,
because
that would bring
I went
me
into,
to my question.
Okay,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
Go ahead.
No. Well, that's what I'm saying is that I didn't know. When I went into probate court, my dad was assigned a guardian ad litem, and then, you know, my stepmother had a lawyer, and then I had a lawyer, and I had to pay my own way. But most of the time, they're billing against the ward's estate. So, in other words, my dad was under a POA. He's now in a full-blown guardianship. Because I was amicable, and I said, no, just give it to the stepmother, he wasn't put into a court-appointed guardianship. You understand what I mean? So he was able to stay at home. He was able to be in his own environment. I didn't challenge that. I could have challenged it, but I didn't. You know, my father was, you know, roaming around Beverly Hills with, you know, barely dressed, you know, disheveled and with Alzheimer's, and nobody was caring for my dad. But okay. I didn't want to take him out of his natural habitat, you know?
Right. Well, you pretty much answered the question because I was going to ask you about the probate court and you know, about asking the judge for visitation rights back in 2009 in California. So that pretty much answered the question. But I did also want to ask you, what kind of precautions can a person take not to be dragged into probate court? I mean, you covered some of that.
Yeah, that's the other amazing thing. It's like you look at Ray Price, you know, I mean, Janie Price, his wife of, I think, you know, 35, 45 years, she reached out to me for help because she was getting swallowed into the probate system. And she kept crying on the phone and saying, we did everything. We had all of our paperwork in order, you know, Ray's wishes were supposed to be met. And then, you know, everything vanished because probate took over.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say a few things. I would say that, you know, in all of your paperwork, you should have at least 6 successors listed, not 1, not 2, not 5, over 5, to have make sure that if you're ever taken to the hospital and you're on your way somewhere, that you have somebody advocating on your behalf. I mean, never, ever, as you're aging or if you have any disabilities, ever be put in a situation where you're by yourself. Because then you don't have anybody advocating for you to protect you and your best interests. Those are a couple of steps that I would take.
Those are very good steps. And I'd like to let people understand, too, that just because you're a celebrity, this goes far beyond that. It goes into family. I have celebrity status as well. Say, for instance, B.B. King and Glenn Campbell and, of course, Mickey Rooney and Casey Kasem, all of these things, it happens to families all over the world. And with this Peter Falk bill in place, if you guys can go to the website and look at the Peter Falk bill, get an understanding of that bill and learn how to implement it into your state, go ahead and get it and make it work for you because it's very important, very important. Because so many people...
I'm sorry. Yeah, what I was going to say, too, is that... you know, I know with power of attorney, when you overextend your duties under POA, that typically if you call the police and, you know, people say, oh, I called the police and they don't do anything. Law enforcement really has dropped the ball, because what happens when you call law enforcement, they say, oh, this is a civil matter, you need to take this to probate court, and we're not getting involved. But, you know, I know some people in California that were pretty relentless about it, and they filed restraining orders against the power of attorney, person in charge, and they were able to prevail in court, you know. I mean, there are things that you can do without dragging your loved one into a full-blown guardianship, which you really don't want to do, because then you just run the risk of that person being isolated and put into a nursing home and having their rights removed, you know?
Yes, exactly. I totally understand. And that's the most, that's the horrible thing about it, you know, is trying to go through the steps and trying to do what you can to make it right when everybody else is pulling against you to make it also wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Artist Lost. This is your radio host, Gigi Adams-Evans, along with my co-host, Anna Marie Holliday. And, of course, we have a caller on the line. If you'd like to jump in at any time to ask any questions, please feel free to do so. We have Ms. Catherine Falk, the daughter of the late, great, iconic actor, Mr. Peter Falk, here on our radio show tonight. It's a great privilege to have her here to talk about the Peter Falk Bill. And so if you'd like to call in, that number is 646-200-3817. We'd like to engage in dialogue with you and any questions that you would have concerning the Peter Falk Bill. Back to you, Anna.
Thank you very much. It is 621 at this time. We're going to take a short break, so go get some water, and thank you again for joining us on the Artist Loft Show. And we're going to hear some music from Miss Gigi.
All right. Thank you so much, PJ. I'm sorry, PJ. I'm calling you. She's already at home. Hi, PJ. I hope you're doing well, and I hope your mom is doing well as also. We're going to I'm just going to give out a few information pieces about advertisements and whatever, and we'll go back for that in a moment, and I will play a brief music break. So, Ms. Falk, if you'd like to get you some water, some drink, or whatever, take off your shoes and relax, and we'll be right back after this short break. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gigi Adams-Evans again, and I'd like to give shout-outs right now at this particular time, instead of playing the music at this moment, to my very special friends, family, everyone that's calling in tonight to support us and to listen to our very special guest, Ms. Catherine Falk, again, the daughter of the late, great, iconic actor, Mr. Peter Falk. And we're here tonight to talk about a Peter Falk bill. I'd like to say hello to Ms. Arlene Brown Mitchell of the Arlene Brown Mitchell TV Network, also to Dr. Reverend Ghani, also to, oh, let's see, Jensenius T. Lodge Jr. of Wise Mind Radio Show, another show that we have engagements in and productions on, that Modern Philosopher, and of course, P.J. Stampson, who is our very wonderful webmaster, jack-of-all-trades person who helps me to get this show going on a regular scale here. So I'd like to say congratulations to everyone for being here tonight, and also to Dr. Billy Hanna Amon in Switzerland, my good friend, PhD, and her daughter, Sophie, who is with the Junebug Dance Company, and all of her friends involved in that. So you can look her up, the Junebug Dance Company, on Vimeo.com, and check her out. She has some great theater movements and dancing, and I think you'll be very impressed with that. Back to you, Anna.
Thank you very much. Well, this question is for Catherine. If a person finds that their parents are going through early dementia, and can they take their parents to sign documentation so that they do not fall into these situations with power of attorney?
Well, of course it can. I mean, the idea is that you want to have all of your documentation in order when the person has capacity to do so, because then you run the risk of having a challenging the capacity of the person as well. You know what I mean? So I think that that's really critical to do that. You just want to hedge this off at the pass before the person is potentially incapacitated, because it negates the very thing that you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, does the doctor have to declare that they're in that stage of early dementia?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's what happened with, Randy Meisner, you know. You really should. I mean, if I have an aging parent and there are slow signs of dementia, you would have to have, you know, take your parent or your loved one to a doctor, a psychiatrist, and be cleared. Because, you know, what if this person has lost complete capacity? Then, you know, it makes any of the paperwork null and void. It's not valid.
Exactly. That's.
I mean, you know, that's a big scam that a lot of family members do. They, you know, they rush their loved one in to, you know, to sign a bunch of paperwork and a documentation, and then it's proven that the person didn't have capacity to sign, you know, to sign their name to this paperwork.
Yes, exactly. Catherine, something that intrigues me a little bit about this guardianship, I have a lot of questions. I have been reading the bill. And very informative, very educational. I will try to implement it in my state as well here. But, however, when the courts found that Mr. Fault was being well cared for and you were still denied the request, what other actions could you take or did you take to make sure that you were able to have some kind of visitation rights? What happened?
Well, I wasn't denied. I don't know what you mean because the petition was granted. So I went in. I'm a little bit confused about your question. The judge granted me. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, how the court? Well, as I was reading from a research piece, it said that, however, the court found that Falk was being well cared for and denied the request for any guardianship. I was just wondering if that applied to you, or was it from the person that was taking care of him at that particular time?
Right. So in my case, when I went into court, again, my father's wife, second wife, was, you know, had durable power of attorney. When I went to the judge, I said to the judge, I want to withdraw the conservatorship petition over the estate. I don't want to be associated with coming in here to question the monetary value or, you know, question how money is being spent. And then I also said to the judge right at the onset, I want you to award his wife conservatorship, because that's the loophole, is that in order to get visitation, it was, you know, to get visitation in my circumstance, you had to go in and petition for conservatorship. And see, that's where they get you. It's a hornet's nest is what it is. And it's really an unfortunate situation. But so when I drafted the bill, my hope at the beginning, at the onset, was to say, how do we avoid probate court at all and just streamline the process and come up with visitation language and say, okay, now you have this visitation language that is law and it doesn't necessarily throw somebody into a guardianship. And over the years of my advocacy, I realized when I was drafting or when I had the attorney draft that the bill at the very beginning was initiating guardianships because it was addressing people that were not already in guardianships. How do I explain this? I hope you understand what I'm saying. But basically by dragging a loved one into probate court that's not in a guardianship, you then create the very thing that you're trying to avoid. So when I partnered up with the National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse, the director said to me, hey, you know, the bill that you have in California and the one in New York is flawed. I need you to withdraw the one in New York and let's try to draft a new bill only addressing wards already in guardianships that are being isolated so that we are not responsible for perpetuating, creating, and instigating unnecessary guardianships with somebody that's in an abusive POA. So then I withdrew the bill from New York, I withdrew the bill from New Jersey, and then because of Glenn Campbell in Tennessee and our legal drafters in Tennessee, we were able to craft a brand new standalone bill that only addresses guardianship, isolation and guardianships, so that we were not going to be causing more guardianships. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. Very, very, very clearly. Yes.
I hope so. Okay, because a lot of people don't understand it.
No, I'm understanding it very much so, yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so then because of Glenn Campbell, we wrote a bill that addresses visitation rights with good guardians, they don't isolate their wards. They don't isolate people like my dad. They just don't do that. So we're not trying to challenge good guardianships and good guardians because, you know, there are a lot of good guardians out there. There are. But what we're saying is that, you know, I mean, there are, you know, public, you know, court-appointed guardians and, you know, private guardianship has become like an industry, you know, it's a huge industry,
yeah.
And it's really motivated by money and greed. And that's what we're trying to hedge off.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I know this sounds really simplistic, but you look at the homeless, you know, you look at people that are need, you know, shelter, food, and nobody's taking care of them. You know, they're out in the street, they're begging for food, and we're not guardianizing these people that really are in need of services because there's no money to get from them. There's no money to be generated. And then I, you know, when I worked in the jails, when I worked in probation and I was working, you know, and I was around inmates, and I saw how well we treat inmates. I mean, we give them phone calls, and they have proper medical care, and they have legal representation. And I thought, and then I visited nursing homes where, you know, the elderly population in nursing homes, they're treated far worse than inmates are. And I thought, this is a really backward system. It's really backwards mm-hmm. when people in jail are being treated better than our elders are in nursing homes. There's something really wrong. Something wrong.
I agree because, well, in a nursing home, I've been in nursing homes myself to visit. I was also a caregiver myself at one particular time in my life with my loved one. But I think that there are good guardians and there are bad guardians as well because of the fact that what does it take for a person to petition the court in case of an incident where, let's say, a person has guardianship and a person's only allowed to come in at certain times and then they're watched, they're videotaped, and then they leave this person at home by themselves to live independently when the Alzheimer's is spiraling down rapidly and they can't do anything about it. You know, they're putting wrong stuff in their hair. They're dangerously, you know, doing things at the oven in the kitchen. They don't have any
mm-hmm.
insight. So how can a person petition the court, say for instance a clause that's in a guardianship decree, so for lack of a better word, how can a person petition the court to stop this because of the fact that only one person has their God, you know, in a certain way.
Yes.
To just say, well, you can't do this, you can't do that. How can that person petition the court to make the changes so they can be as important as that one guardian who is not really doing anything but just, you know, officiating or just say giving out rules and just being that person that you can't do this, like I said, and you can't do that. How can they petition a court for that?
Well, unfortunately, they have to, you know, you have to have an attorney and you have to go in and you have to file a petition, you know, our visitation petition says, you know, to gain access and whatnot. The thing is that the real inherent problem here is that there is absolutely no oversight and there's no accountability. So these guardians get away with murder. I mean, literally, they get away with murder. It's unbelievable. You know, unless you're willing to have an attorney and go into court, it's like they know that their pockets are deeper and that they're not going to get caught, or they think they're not going to get caught. And so family members or, you know, people that are concerned are left scrambling. And it's a flawed system. It really is. And this is why guardians do this, is because they know that they can get away with it. They know. And it's just deplorable. It's absolutely deplorable. And, you know, it's so sad because somebody, a ward who has a physical disability or, you know, is mentally not capable of speaking out, who is advocating for them? Who is looking out for them when a guardian is isolating them and exploiting them? And that's what's really, it's so disheartening, you know, because you think
mm-hmm.
that when we're aging, that we're going to be protected and we're going to be loved and we're going to be nurtured. And so often they're just treated terribly, you know, just terrible. I mean, I've walked into nursing homes and I just can't believe what they're doing. I just can't believe how these people are treated. I just can't believe
it. Yeah, very, very badly. And what can you do about it? You can't do anything about it, you know, but you can complain all you want to, but it's not going to help anyone at that particular time because they can also say that, you know, you're wrong, you're mistaken. That's not what you see. It's, you know, pull and pull and pull and pull.
Go ahead. Well, what I was just going to say is a lot of times an unscrupulous guardian will pit family members against other family members. So, you know, typically a lot of times the court appoints a public guardian because they just don't want to get involved in the big family mess and figure out which sibling is more responsible than the other sibling. So nine times out of ten, the courts are appointing these public strangers. They're basic strangers. And so when they're appointing these strangers, then what happens with the public appointed guardian or even a private guardian is they isolate the ward by filing restraining orders against the very family members that are challenging the merits and the, you know, credibility of the guardian. So next thing you know, the guardian is going in and making up lies and saying, oh, these siblings, they're harassing the ward and they're, you know what I mean? They're just making up a pack of lies. So that you've got all these restraining orders. It's just, it's awful. It's awful.
Exactly. It's very terrible. Catherine, I'd like to ask you one more question before Anna interviews you. The bill, the A.3461-C/S.5154-C, requires that the court order appointing a guardian to oversee the care of an incapacitated person to identify all individuals who are entitled to notice to have notice of a person's death. You were denied that right, right? So with Governor Andrew Cuomo, who signed that bill, is that helping any at any point now where a person can be notified of a person's death?
I'm not sure that in the state of California that there's a notification of death. I don't know. I thought that there wasn't. I know that in our bill from Tennessee onward that we made it very clear that we want the death notification put in our visitation in the, you know, the right of association legislation. So that is in full force, absolutely. But I'm not clear if that's in California or not. I'm not clear on that. So I was not at the time. I was not. My sister and I both had no idea where my father was buried. I mean, we basically had to do our own investigation to figure that out.
Wow.
I mean, we basically went from cemetery to cemetery to cemetery, and we were told we can't release any information to you guys because you're not the next of kin. You're not the spouse.
Goodness.
So we basically, we kind of deduced that my dad was at the Westwood Memorial, I mean, where all the celebrities are, but it's pretty awful. Yeah.
I can imagine. We're going to take a few moments, Catherine. You have another caller. Hello, caller from a 352 exchange. How are you tonight?
Hi, this is Aileen Reese. I've been on the Blog Talk Radio before, and it's a wonderful program that they are having in. As a geriatric care manager, we deal with families and family issues. And as a care manager, it breaks my heart to try to, you know, be fair and try to, of course, put the ward, the patient, the client first. And it's very difficult when the loved one has dementia and the family members want to take him for visits and they want to, you know, they're putting demands on me or, you know, family members and the client to take them from their known surroundings, their known caregivers, so they can have a private visit. And it's very, that's one reason I love this program, because it's educating people about dementia, and it puts me in a place that I don't like. I want the loved one to meet with their family, but the family are having different disputes. So you know what I'm talking about. Do you get an idea of what I'm talking about?
Are you a caretaker and a guardian, or are you a geriatric nurse?
A geriatric care manager, where I've been in one example is the guardianship failed. So I was brought in to mediate between the children and the stepmother. And the children want to have private visits with their dad, and he has dementia and he has paranoia and he has a Lewy body dementia, which is even a little worse, which means they need to stay in their known surroundings with their known caregivers. And it's just very difficult And the main reason is because they don't understand the condition of their loved one. And it just, I guess the point is we need more education about dementia and about the care of it. And it just, it's very hard when people don't put the loved one.
So what would you, in that situation when you were in the mediation, what would you recommend? What were your recommendations?
Well, I had to bring everybody around to what is best for the loved one. And in his condition, not being oriented to the day, where he is, who he's with, I had to make them understand that the needs of their loved one were more important than them wanting to have a private visit and take him somewhere so they could have like an unsupervised visit. So it's just very difficult.
See,
mediating between families.
I come from the philosophy that when you want to see a loved one, I don't care if there's 10 security guards standing by my father with 16 doctors. I just want to see my father. And to me, it's like fighting over spilled milk. It's just not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, it's so tedious, but the ultimate goal should be that you want to see your parent. And a lot of egos are at the table when they say, well, I don't want to be supervised and I don't want, X, Y, and Z. Well, really?
Exactly.
Because what is at the root of this? And I had, let me tell you something. When I was able to get in to see my father, there were so many eyes on me and it was awful, but I didn't care. Because I was laser beam on my father, and I was honed in on my dad, bringing him music, art, pictures. He's, and I had everybody watching me, and I didn't care because I didn't care what it took to compromise to see my father. And that's what should be that the main focus of people when they're fighting back and forth and, putting all these conditions about visitation. And people should be lucky just to be able to spend time with their loved one. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And they just don't understand the condition and what is best for the loved one. And that's what
this
program
is. I would not have felt comfortable being with my father in his severe condition that he was in when I saw him. I was grateful that there was a nurse there, a doctor there. I felt comfortable that way because what if something happened to my father while I was visiting with him? I would feel terrible because I wouldn't know what to do.
Exactly. And that's another consideration that showed how how much more they didn't understand the real situation.
Right.
So, thank you for your work.
Thank you so much for
everything you're doing.
No, thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Aileen.
Thank you.
Very, very good question. Hey, hang in there. Stay on and listen if you'd like to. We'd like to have you any more questions if you have. Thank you. You're listening to The Artist Loft. This is your radio host, Gigi Adams-Evans, and we're having a very engaging conversation about the Peter Falk Bill, of course, with our very special guest, Miss Catherine Falk, the daughter of the late, great, iconic actor, Mr. Peter Falk. I'm sure you all know about Columbo, and I'm sure you know about the 1001 questions that he asked. And so this show is not going to be about 1001 questions tonight because we're getting all the answers that we need from a wonderful young lady who has created this bill and talks about guardianship, the pros and the cons of guardianship. So tune in and give us a call at 646-200-3817. Back to you, Anna.
Thank you. Catherine, my question is, are you working on any other bills concerning dementia and Alzheimer's? And the second question is, wouldn't it be nice that there will be some kind of bill that each time that a person takes guardianship over their loved one, that they have to go through a class. And not only that, that the state should be able to monitor them just like when you do foster care. If the state sends someone out once a month, every 6 weeks, to monitor what's going on with these children. So I think there should be some kind of bill, some kind of class so that we'll know these things about our loved ones.
Yeah. Repeat the first question. I have the second question. The first question, repeat it again.
Concerning guardianship, I was concerning the guardianship, wouldn't it be nice that that they will be a class on,
You had asked a question just before that too, though, and I just might, the National Guardianship Association, they're supposed to be, hours of training, and there's just not enough training. I think it takes longer to become a landscaper in the United States than it does to become a guardian. It's absolutely ridiculous. You fill out a bunch of paperwork and you take, it's like 6-12 hours of training, and there's virtually just not enough training, because I think you're absolutely right. But I know that, I believe that there is, under the National Guardianship Association and with the Uniform Law Commission, I really do believe that there are requirements. I think that you're right, though. The requirements should be, the bar should be set much higher. Absolutely. I think that's a very valid point.
What if somebody wants to go in and do a law like you did, to set up a law, as you did with the Peter Falk law, to get more done about this, because,
I agree with you, but the opposition, which would be the National Association of, the NGA and the ABA, all the lawyers will come in and testify and say, hey, you're discouraging guardians from doing their job. They're not going to want to do this job. And you're right. My point is, well, then they shouldn't be doing the job at all. They're not willing to go be put through the ringer to be trained to do. I mean, this is the most critical job somebody has, is taking care of a person that is sick or is, has limitations and is aging. And it's just, most of these people are completely unqualified to do the job. And you're absolutely right. So legislation to enforce that, I think that would be great.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just think that, like I said, I'm learning about this, but it is something that, I read somewhere, I'm not for sure where, someone asked a question that, what was your main concern about your number one fear, and, how would you die? And someone said, well, in a long time ago, it used to be cancer. Now people are worried about, if they're going to get dementia or Alzheimer's.
Right.
And so I think that, that sometime, assume that there has to be, or it should be, that advocates, because that's who we are, that we're able to stand up, because, yesterday or last year or 10 years ago, it's your father or grandmother. Today, you can be up.
Right.
So I'm very passionate about,
But I would recommend, Yeah, I would recommend if you look on the NGA's website. I mean, they're basically like, hate to say this and make the analogy, but they're like the NRA with guns. The NGA is, as powerful as the NRA is when it comes to guardianship.
Yeah.
They have so much money in their pockets, and if you go on their website, they talk and tote about how much training is involved and blah, blah, blah. In my opinion, it's smoke and mirrors. There's just no oversight and accountability for this. And I think you're absolutely right. It is terrifying in this country and around the world to age with Alzheimer's, dementia. My bill doesn't really just address the incapacitated person with dementia, though. It really encompasses I hope you know that. Okay.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, and that's so true, because of the fact, Catherine, I would like to ask you a question about the Peter Falk bill again, because that was very interesting. That was a good question too, Anna, and thank you, Catherine, for your answer. But with all of the things that are going on with the Peter Falk bill, what is it like to have a process to pass that bill through both chambers? And what are the steps one needs to take to be successful at it? Because it seems like it's so very difficult, You can't get your
I can explain to you the process, because it is absolutely, it is so arduous, it's tedious, it is, you have to be really passionate and relentless, and you have to persevere through a lot of obstacles. I mean, it's like, one step forward and 10 steps back. And so what happens is you contact your representative, you contact a senator, assemblyman who you believe would be passionate about the cause. You look at their track record, you look at their history of the bills that they've passed, if any of them have addressed aging issues, whatnot. So once you've honed in on, let's say, you know, a senator, this is how I approach it, okay? So I look at, you know, Oregon. Is it predominantly Democrat? Is it predominantly Republican? So in terms of getting my bill passed, if I know it's a blue state, I will approach a Democrat in the aging committee, and I will approach them, and then of course I will say, okay, I need to get a Republican to co-sponsor in the House. So I try to get a sponsor in the Senate, a sponsor in the House, crossing over in both political parties. Otherwise, you know, if you have two Democrats that sponsor, you also need to, you know, try to have a Republican as well, because you have to go through both chambers, you know what I mean, with ease. So what happens is, when you introduce a bill, because of the nature of this bill, it goes into the what's called the Judiciary Committee. So what I like to do is I like to get a sponsor out of the Judiciary Committee. So that's one of seven votes I know that's, you know, that's supporting me. So and then you understand what I mean? So then you go through the, let's say I have a Senate sponsor in the Judiciary. So then we clear that committee. Then you go to the Senate floor. It clears to the Senate floor. And then you've got a sponsor in the House who's already running with the bill. So you've got both chambers that are representing the bill equally so. I mean, that's the ideal scenario. And it doesn't always happen, but that's what I fight for.
So you've been successful in 16 states. How long did it take you to get that success in the 16 states?
Well, I passed seven bills in the 2016 session. So we did seven bills in 2016. We're working with, I would say, between 20 and 25 states now. I've lost track. I've lost count. But in the 2016 session, we did pass we went through seven states.
Seven states, okay. That's pretty good. So with all of this going on, everybody, I'd like you to tune in to The Artist Law from I've lost my name here. What is wrong with me? This is Gigi Adams-Evans, and this is The Artist Law, and my special guest tonight is Catherine Falk, daughter of the late, great, iconic actor Peter Falk, and we're talking about the Peter Falk bill. So if you'd like to engage in dialogue with her and call in about guardianship, the pitfalls, and all the other things about guardianship that you have questions about, please call in at 646-200-3817. And Arlene, would you like to ask another question?
Yes, I would.
Mm-hmm.
When the bill is being presented, I can't see where you would have any opposition. But is there any opposition, and what are the strategies for that?
Well, you know, we have ABA and the NGA oppose us quite a bit. They testify against us because their position is that our bill stagnates, or it creates problems for the guardian. Because they don't want more oversight for the guardian. They assume that all guardians are good and that guardians are doing their job effectively. So by our bill, you know, holding them accountable, it's a pain in the neck. And so you really have to cross your T's and dot your I's when you're presenting a bill. You have to really read the language of the bill that you're presenting and understand it. And you also have to know what the current statutes are in the given state to know what you're up against. Current laws are already in effect, because many times, you know, the Attorney General or the National Guardianship Association will say, well, the laws are already in place and they're already working. Well, no, they're not. So you need to look up what statutes are there and what statutes are not being enforced. I mean, it's really something else. I mean, when you're having big, big organizations testify against you, it's tough. I have to say, it's really tough.
Yeah.
So the other thing
I can imagine, because those are big organizations with big lobbies.
Yeah. Really big lobbyists. I mean, huge. And that's why it's important to have AARP or huge organizations that are about protecting the elderly. Or, you know, we have ARC of California, ARC of Washington. They are, you find organizations that are about protecting the disabled and the elderly, and they'll say, hey, I'll come in and testify for you. You have to have a huge backing behind you. And I have gone into states where I haven't done my homework in the beginning, and I go in by myself, and I, you know, it's not advisable, you know.
Yeah.
So I've learned the hard way that I have to have an army behind me to, you know, take on big organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're gonna have to. Yeah. Yes, that's the only way that you can ever get any results. But Catherine, what is the difference between guardianship and the power of attorney issue? How does that pertain in seeking visitation rights? How can that help a person?
You know, power of attorney is a precursor to guardianship, really. I mean, power of attorney is limited. I mean, it's about, you know, setting up your who's going to take care of you, who's going to make health care decisions for you in case you get sick. But they don't have as much power as somebody that is under a guardianship. A guardian has total control over the person in the estate. I mean, that's, they're incapacitated, they've been deemed incapacitated. Somebody that's under power of attorney still has capacity. They still have their rights intact. Mm-hmm. They, you know what I mean? There's so much more, like my father, he was not incapacitated at the time, so his wife had power of attorney over him, but he still retained all of his rights. But then by having a guardian, that's the court has appointed, that has said basically this person has lost capacity and therefore is completely controlled by a guardian. It's just one more step of control that you want to hedge off or delay for as long as humanly possible in somebody's life. That's just my opinion, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah. I do agree. I'll
you want somebody to retain their rights as long as possible. You really do.
Exactly. Exactly.
And a guardianship really removes all those rights.
Exactly. Catherine, you have another caller. Hello, calling from a 210 exchange. How are you tonight? You're
I'm
listening
fine,
to the
thank
audience.
You.
Thank you. With our special guest, Ms. Catherine Falk. Do you have a question for Ms. Falk?
Not necessarily a question. This is an advocate friend of hers in Texas who works with her. My name is Debbie Valdez, and I'm also working on guardianship reform in the state of Texas.
Oh, hello. Debbie. I love Debbie.
Welcome to
Hi,
the show.
Hi, Catherine. I'm glad I caught your show. I'm sorry I've been really super busy, but I was listening to your show, and I just wanted to offer some support to you and help in giving some better understanding about the new industry of guardianship in the country that is deteriorating and destroying families across the nation. And I think one important thing that is missing here that Catherine has not been able to get to share with you all is the fact that there is an industry now of guardianship service providers, and they are being held at the same standard as a family guardian. They are two complete different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
The family guardian is held to very strict standards opposed to your professional and private guardians. And this is the kind of, this is the areas that we're working to change for the simple fact that our loved ones are having all of their constitutional rights completely stripped and handed over to a person, a stranger, like Catherine mentioned earlier, to manage the affairs of that individual and make all decisions for that individual. And there is severe lack of oversight and monitoring of these particular types of guardians in this industry. And that is the responsibility of the courts. And the courts lack that supervision for these guardians. However, they are held at a much different standard. Many of them are attorneys. Many of them are certified in under our state laws, and they have to take a four-hour training course. Pretty much that's it. And to manage the affairs, the financial affairs, and all decision-making authority for another person. And this has become a very serious issue, to the point to where when your family member is not appointed as the guardian for your loved one, and you have a third-party guardian appointed, then anytime you challenge that guardian in regards to your parent being neglected or abused or exploited, and you bring it to the attention of anyone, the first course of action is usually retaliation, and they strip the family of all their right to even visit with their loved one. And that's what Catherine is pretty much talking about in
this
area.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. I'd like to ask you a question. With Catherine was talking about good and bad guardians. Say, for instance, let's put a quote unquote a bad guardian, a person that has, say, for instance, cameras in the house, leaving them to be independently on their own. You know, after a certain amount of time, when that caregiver is in the house, supposedly taking care of this person. Then you have a loved one that may come in to help with this person, and that the loved one is wanting to stay, but they have to leave because of guardianship rules. How can that be changed? And Catherine, is that also implemented in your bill?
That's not implemented in the bill, no. And Debbie,
no,
it's not implemented.
Yeah, it's not implemented. But under those circumstances, what needs to be understood that any time you have got an issue with a guardian, specifically a guardianship service provider or a professional guardian, that issue is only addressed in a court of law.
Right.
I understand.
When it is a family guardian, it's much easier to manage that if there is an issue with the guardian, the family guardian, because, you know, here in Texas, all it takes is for someone to contact the court, and they can remove you as a guardian with the snap of a finger. Whereas these other type guardians who are court or, you know, certified and professionals, it takes an act of Congress to get them removed.
Because it's kind of like on a level of wealth management, kind of like a possessiveness in a way, and I was just asking because I was curious. I've noticed, I know, you know, quite a few people that have experienced that in their lives, and you know, they're not able to do anything about it, just out of curiosity, and I'm sure that they're listening in on the show because of that fact, because this, the one guardian in particular can give out orders and say you can't do this and you can't do that, even though they're not doing anything to help the person, you know, their loved one that's there, you know, leaving them with people that are that are uncaring. You know, they're just there for the money. You know, so it would take a long time, I would imagine, to get them out of that guardianship position that they're in. And like Catherine said, you have to petition the courts for that. Just out of curiosity, I wanted to know that. Back
yeah,
to you.
And here in Texas, the law is if you're the guardian, you don't need to hire an attorney. All right, that doesn't apply to family guardians. That only applies to those who are certified or professional guardians. So if you're a family member and you see, let's say, for instance, you have your parent under another family guardian, well, that family member can bring an action to the court, and then the court appoints attorneys to represent the ward or the person in guardianship.
Right.
And you are left to hire your own attorney to challenge the other guardian, you know, challenge the guardian. But when the shoe is on the other foot, where it's a professional guardian or a certified guardian, and you're seeing them, you know, neglecting, abusing, or exploiting your loved one, you still have to go out and hire a lawyer to contest or complain
right.
to the court.
Nobody
yeah.
wants to be dragged right. into probate court over some family dispute, so there should
right.
be.
Right, it just becomes an issue to generate income for all the court appointees.
Right, and Gigi, this is Aileen. I just have a follow-up question. So if you do have a family guardian that you would like to challenge, and you're another family member, doesn't that put you in the compromising position that if you do take it to the court will appoint a non-family guardian and you may be worse off than you were with
yes.
the family guardian?
Yes.
Yes,
yes, most definitely.
Yes.
Yes.
150%, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
not even though you – yeah. So even though you don't like the way your family guardian is treating your family member, it puts you in between a rock and a hard place. Are you going to challenge your family and they end up worse? Or, yeah, it's very difficult for a family member in that position.
Exactly, and that's the whole purpose of Catherine's legislation, is to restore the rights, to restore the visitation rights for the person under guardianship. Because under that law, therefore mm-hmm. that would not deprive that person under guardianship from being able to be visited by other people, friends or family or other members, interested people,
mm-hmm.
to be able to protect that individual from their guardian.
The caveat to that, too, is that right now the National Association of Stop Guardian Abuse, we partner together, and we are drafting legislation in the power of attorney statutes, because I really believe that that's the antecedent to guardianships. And so if we can create language and legislation that, you know, hedges us off, addressing isolation, exploitation, and whatnot in power of attorney, that's where a lot of guardianships are created. And on top of that, the NASA and I are also drafting legislation in the criminal codes, trying to make isolation a crime. Caretakers, guardians are caretakers, and it just seems that guardians are exempt from, from crimes. I mean, they're just seem completely, they get away with so much, you know. So we're trying
because
to
of lack of oversight.
Yeah, accountability and oversight, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the ultimate guardian becomes the judge of the court. That's
exactly.
who the ultimate guardian is the judge of the court. So
mm-hmm.
there should never be any opportunity under guardianship. There should never be any opportunity for a person to abuse, neglect, or exploit an elderly person or a disabled person who is under
mm-hmm.
guardianship. Because that is the whole purpose of guardianship in the first place. So when you have guardianship abuse by anybody, family member or a professional guardian, that should not be allowed by any standard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, it occurs every day.
Hey, Debbie, to clarify and help me with this and explain it to them, with the NGA, they have all these guidelines and all of the like this manual of what's expected by a guardian. Do you recall what the what they say? I don't have it in front of me.
Well, every state, the National Guardianship Association has developed minimum standards that they are supposed to that regulates them as far as providing guardianship services. So
mm-hmm.
every state has adopted some, all, of those standards. Some states have a guardianship board, a guardianship certification board, or like we have the Judicial Branch Certification Commission here that oversees the guardians, that they do not violate their standards under the professionals by providing the professional service of guardianship services. However,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day, even if you have oversight of the guardians, that does not remove a guardian. A guardian can only be removed in a court proceeding. So the entities that we have to oversee guardians, they regulate them, and they have a complaint process so that you can file a complaint, and that entity will discipline the guardian, sanction the guardian, terminate their certification to provide these services. But that's pretty much all they can do, okay? But they cannot remove the guardian. That would take a court. So even if they terminate a guardianship certification, doesn't mean you're going to remove the guardian, because that has to take place in the court of law.
Mm.
Only a judge
wow.
can remove a guardian.
That is so cruel. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is very...
It was a system designed by attorneys and judges, okay? So, they're all better protected than the actual person in guardianship.
It seems that way. Because everybody has to understand that the Peter Falk bill, it seeks to remove the barriers and, you know, to get it everywhere that's needed, you know, to promote strong family relationships is the best thing in the world. But, you know, everything is controlled by the judicial system, and that's kind of, it's not right. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with that, kind of trying to digest that.
It's kind of like the same system that we have designed for Child Protective Services.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's really terrible.
They remove your children from your care, and then you've got foster care providers, and you've got attorney ad litem and guardian ad litem, everybody appointed for the vulnerable person, you know,
mm-hmm.
where they lose their voice and their authority to be able to make any decisions or ask, you know, or request for to be back with their family. They never see the inside of the court. Everyone is making decisions for them, you know, and they're just a commodity.
And doesn't it seem, Debbie, too, that the judges seem to, by and large, support guardians and whatever they say? I mean, it's like, you know, like they're the supreme god. You know, it's difficult to challenge guardians.
Right.
They
put all of their trust in these particular guardians, and you have to understand that, you know, this is like a catch-22 here. When you report to the court, or you have the opportunity to file a complaint against the guardian to go into the court, here in Texas, you have to hire a lawyer to complain. And if they want you to pay a security for cost, you have to pay a security cost in the tens of thousands of dollars if the judge requires you to pay that cost. So, I mean, we have designed a system that in order to complain, it's going to cost you. So, however, in this particular scenario, they do, because when you look at the judge, he's appointing that guardian, so he's putting all his trust in that guardian.
Right.
And if you end up with a bad guardian, it's not a very good reflection on the judge.
No,
so it's a matter of, you know, for the judge to come in and say, oh, my God, I made a mistake. I put this guardian in charge of this elderly person, and they abused that individual, and I didn't step up to the plate to protect that ward or that person under guardianship. It's a reflection on the judge.
The other issue becomes, too, is that because the probate system is so inbred, you have the probate attorneys, you have the judge, you have the guardian ad litem. They're all kind of working in unison with each other. And then you've got somebody who challenges the system, and you're really, you know, you're just in a bad position when you walk in to a system like that. I mean, look what's happening in Texas, Debbie, you know?
Yep. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, I have a relative.
Yes, and, you know, and it's all, you know, the sad thing about it is the individual, the elderly person who has dementia or Alzheimer's, who has these particular type of guardians. Like I said, when it comes to a family guardian, if you have your loved one in a nursing home and you're the family guardian, or you even have them in your own home, and someone was to complain about your care that you're providing to your loved one, you could be easily removed. They could just take you away, and if APS is called or someone makes a referral to the court that the elderly person is being abused, neglected, or exploited by their family member, they make a referral to the court. The court then sends out an investigator or appoints a guardian ad litem, and they come in and they investigate and they determine whether that individual needs a guardian. That individual needs to be removed, and they can just remove them.
Wow.
And sometimes these, our loved ones, have capacity. They're fully capable of making their own decisions, but in order for the probate system to have jurisdiction over the person, they then request a capacity hearing, to be evaluated. And then they're deemed incapacitated by the doctors. I mean, they have court-appointed, I don't know if they're court-appointed doctors, but they have doctors that basically work for the courts, in essence. And then they rubber-stamp everybody incapacitated. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so then you have to challenge that, and then you have to have your own private doctors counter the very evaluations that are going into court to say this person no longer has capacity. Because probate court can't really control the person unless they rubber-stamp them and say, okay, this person's incapacitated.
They
Does that make sense?
They can't create a guardianship without it. without a medical examination that determines incapacitation.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And
well,
most
I
courts,
have a question.
And, you know, there's courts with limited guardianship. I mean, there are guardianships that are limited guardianships where allows a person to be able to have some say in decision-making or managing their affairs or whatever. And then there's a plenary guardianship, which is a full guardianship where you lose all your rights. And under those type of guard, and the courts don't honor very many limited guardianships. We haven't seen that many because it's too inconvenient for the courts to manage someone with a limited guardianship because it's going to take a lot of time to pay attention to what that individual is doing. So it's difficult, especially if it's one of the guardians in the industry. You know, most likely any time a third-party guardian, a non-family guardian is appointed, it's usually with full authority.
Mm.
Well, I have a question. Catherine.
Wait,
can I
just interrupt for 1 second? Marcia Southwick is on the call, and she's one of the directors to NASA, and I hope you can let her in on this phone call if you don't mind.
Yes, I was going to interrupt to say I have another caller on a 505 exchange.
Yeah.
Hello, caller.
Oh, that's great.
All right, hello,
hello?
Caller. Hi, you're welcome to the Artist Loft.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Hello. I was going to say, Catherine mentioned that, you know, that the courts were, it's sort of very cozy. They know each other.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the problem, for example, in New Mexico, where I live, the way it's done is the petitioning attorney comes in and petitions the court, and he chooses the people on the case. So what was revealed in this big five-part series by Diane Diamond on guardianship was that the same people are on case after case after case where there's a lot of money. And so that's a huge problem because anybody going into that court doesn't know any of this. So suddenly you just feel like you're in a shark tank. And and there's a lot more going on than you realize at the time. And so people aren't informed. They have no clue what's coming their way. There's no education about it. Nobody informs you of your rights. I mean, if you're a criminal, you get informed of your rights. But if you're a prospective ward, nobody tells you anything, or the family. They don't tell you, guess what, everybody's going to lose their rights and you're going to have all your money taken. You know, I mean, they don't say anything about what's to come. And I think
exactly,
that's really a tragedy.
Exactly.
And then
the other problem is,
Catherine was saying, you know, how guardians just aren't subjected to the same criminal laws that other people are. You know, if a guardian decides to lock your mom up in her room, that's protection. If I do it, it's abuse.
Mm-hmm. Like that's 22, like she said. That's really strange. But let me ask Catherine or anyone that can. Well, Catherine, if you could answer this question for me. In guardianship in a home, I had asked earlier, what about a person that's a bad guardian? Just say, for instance, that this person is way away in another state, okay? And that person that, you know, the person that has the dementia is there with two or three different people. There's only one person that really cares about this person, you know, this person's condition. But she's being or he's being fought by the guardian to not to do these certain things. They'd have to go back to court again, I guess, to petition, you know, the right to be able to intervene in the person's, the loved one's life. Is that how it goes?
Most courts, I'm sorry, Catherine, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Most courts, most of the laws in the states, they do allow any interested person to motion the court. So if you do have an interest, you know, a situation like that, you can motion the court. And a lot of times it doesn't happen because the court can come back and say, like here in Texas, they would say, you need a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to hire an attorney to represent you in a proceeding to act in the best interest of an individual, it comes with a cost, and it becomes a financial barrier, and it's difficult to be able to support that individual no matter how interested you are. However, if it's a family guardian, you can always contact, you know, Adult Protective Services, but they don't have, you know, the statutory authority to do anything with the guardian other than to report it to the court, because the court has the statutory authority to oversee the guardian.
I see.
I have a question about that, because in the state of Texas, there's something that's called legal aid. Will legal aid not represent you if you don't have the funds? Because one could go into this just saying, you know what, I don't have any money, I'm just going to leave it, and then you feel that, you know, there's nothing that you can do about that. Is legal aid a possibility?
The experiences we've had with legal aid here in Texas is that they assist people to create guardianships. They will provide services if they have the funding in their, you know, in their budget to continue to provide, you know, assisting someone to create a guardianship. But when it comes to challenging or contesting or complaining, those costs can become very, very expensive, and they don't represent people under those circumstances. At least that's what's been my experience when I have advocated for families looking for legal services. I have referred them to the legal services, Texas Legal Services here, and they call me back and say they won't take it because of the circumstance. And that's already because it's a guardianship that's been created, not one that is going to be created.
Wow. Okay, well, the Department of Aging is supposed to be anonymous, I believe, that when you report something, and some of the people won't report it, another loved one won't report it because they're afraid that somehow they're going to find out that, you know, it's not a unanimous reporting. So can someone tell me how do you equip someone that doesn't have any funds to go in? What do they do? Do they take documentation, notarize? What are the tools to get to the point that you're saying, listen, my parents are getting abused and I need this third party out of here, or is it just no hope?
My suggestion would be to be able to send a letter to the court. You know, you would have to file a letter with the court clerk and let the court, because you can't contact the judge. That would be considered ex parte communication, and judges aren't supposed to practice under that. However, you can always go to the court and file something, you know, file a notification with the court investigator, and I would recommend to put it in writing so that it goes into the guardianship file, and that should create some oversight from the court, and at that time the court should send out someone, a court visitor or someone, you know, to come and look and check on the ward, on the person under guardianship. But I can only speak for what happens here in Texas. I can't really speak on what kind of procedure or process they have in other states.
Ladies and gentlemen,
that doesn't necessarily work in anyone's favor either. You know, you just have to, that would be the process. If you can't afford an attorney, you know, it would be, you know, any interested person can contact the court and let them know that you've got an individual you're concerned about and what the concerns are, and have the court initiate someone to come out and do an investigation on the individual. And then it's in the court's hands, because at the end of the day, they are responsible for overseeing the protection of that person under guardianship.
Thank you. Yes. Back in your hands, Ms. Gigi.
All right. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Artist's Loss, Gigi Adams-Evans, and my co-host, Ms. Anna Marie Holliday. and of course our other co-host TJ, who is away with maintenance for her mom. We're talking to Miss Catherine Falk, the daughter of the late great Peter Falk, actor, Columbo actor, TV series, and we need your help, ladies and gentlemen, in helping to pass the Peter Falk bill along to your state. Miss Falk has really, really inspired everyone to listen to her, to read her, go to her website and look up the Peter Falk bill. The Peter Falk bill, through her own personal suffering, she was denied even seeing her father sick. She was denied even knowing where he was buried. So if you can go in and get some information on her website, you can go directly to Catherine Falk, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E-F-A-L-K organization.org, to find out all the information that you need. There are resources there for you to learn, visitation resources about the issues that are at hand, the Peter Falk bill in its own entirety. Get it. Learn how to educate yourself on your rights as a person who loves a person who has dementia and Alzheimer's, because it's not easy being rejected. It's not easy being rejected when you want to just see someone. There are guardianship rules now and laws that keep you from doing that. Do you really want that? Do something about it. Get involved. Get involved. Back to you, Ada.
Just want to say thanks again, Catherine, for coming.
Yes, Catherine.
Oh, no, thank you.
For being on the show, our special guest. And Debbie, thank you again for coming and giving us some insights on what are the laws here in Texas and Ireland. It's also a pleasure that you joined us on today, and our co-host PJ. And I've been very blessed by just the information, and I plan on being the advocate for this cause, not just for dementia and Alzheimer's, but for those that are aging. Back to you, Ms. Gigi.
All right, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, all the guests that called in. And, Eileen, we hope to have you back on the show again as a guest to talk about, you know, your updates for being a geriatric caregiver. Catherine, we really appreciate you being here. We look forward to having you back on the show at any time that you're ready, and we're really interested in helping you to support the Peter Falk bill. So thank you very much, and I know that you miss your dad. We all miss him because he was a great actor, and I can't imagine anything. I can imagine him asking questions, 1,001 questions to everyone, because he was, and if he was here, I'm sure he'd be on this radio show right now. Well, Catherine, thank you very much for that informative information, and we do hope to have you back again, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. And you all have a wonderful evening. Thank you, Anna, for being there with me to support and help with the questions. I really appreciate you and your presence. May God bless everyone. Thank you so much. And good night, everyone.
Have a good night.
Have a wonderful
good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to The Artist's Law, and we hope that you've enjoyed this information with my special guest, Miss Catherine Falk, the daughter of the late, great Peter Falk. And again, we hope to engage in more activity for you to join us in being motivated and dementia movement. You can join us on rebirthforlove.com on our web pages to help engage in certain activities that we're doing. We're supporting, we're advocates for dementia and Alzheimer, along with my special friend and co-host tonight, who was not able to be on the show tonight. But we really appreciate it, and I really wanted to get a chance to play some music tonight, but the conversation was so wonderful and was so that I just put the music, you know, away for a minute. So, again, this is Gigi Adams-Evans again with The Artist's Law, and for everybody that came in tonight and helped, I really appreciate it. May you all have a wonderful day. And as usual, I play at the last ending of a show a very special poem. It's called Words by Mother May. May you enjoy it, and good night.
Words. Words are most important because the first thing you heard, they were spoken to you. Words in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. God spoke and said, let there be words. As a child, what do you remember most? The sound of your mother's voice? Words. What does a parent try to encourage intensely? She listens for her baby to say words. What is your name? A word. The Bible says the power of life and death is in the tongue. Words. Wars are started because of words. Your commitment is made to God with words. A marriage is consummated with words. Love and hate, two small words, yet two of the most powerful words. The Word of God said, let the weak say, I am strong. Words. The greatest deceiver used words to deceive Eve and used words to tempt the Word. If words carry life or death, how careless are you handling them? Think how important your words are in your confession of faith, even in how you go through today. If God was not a man of his word, where would we be today? What hope would we have? My words uplift when spoken in love. They cast down when spoken with guile. Words can set free or bound, as if I give you all, give you, or I shall never forgive you. Words can bring exceeding great joy or utter despair. Our words can utterly change our life. Yes, Lord, oh, how small the phrase, but oh, so awesome when said from the heart. Words, I'm saved, and even greater the joy when words that man cannot understand flow from their lips, the unknown tongues, words. People die, worlds crumble, but words live on. There are many books in the world, more than you and I could ever read, but there is just one word that can change the course of life, the word God calls his son. For this word was with God, and this word was made flesh and dwelt among men. And now this word abides in me, you, and all believers. And when we speak, we should be saying, and this said the Lord. We use letters for words, but God used words to form worlds. We communicate through the movement of the hand, shuffle of the body, the wink of the eye, a mild nod of the head, and yes, even with a pat on the back. But nothing is more profound than the spoken word. What can be any greater than a word spoken by a person waking up out of a coma, or forming words by a stroke patient? Words can be hid away and yet kept. Thy words have I hid in my heart, that I might not sin against thee. Words, I can meditate, I can ponder, but there is nothing more satisfying than crying out before God. Help me, Lord. Oh, thank you, Lord. Word. And in the end, what will be the words we hear? Well done, or I know you're not. Terror or joy? Word. God spoke to me, and he said, don't confess nothing you don't want. So I admonish you to be careful with your words.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That was Mother May, a dementia sufferer herself, with a very, very creative gift of poetry and lyrics. I'd like to say we all wish you a very happy evening, and I hope that God blesses one of you in every way that you can bless someone else in another way. For each one, teach one. This is your radio host, Gigi Adams-Evans, along with my co-host, Miss Anna Marie Holliday, and, of course, PJ, who is away with her mother on maintenance. So God bless you all, and have a wonderful evening. Good night.